This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, Super Bowl week, and we are rocking and rolling as we get you ready for Super Bowl 58. As the Chiefs and the San Francisco 49ers have arrived in the city of Las Vegas, they will have their big media event tonight. And then off we go to the analysis and the deep dives and everything that you want to know about the game. Oh, from those halftime show comments to the prop bets that are always popular for the Super Bowl. But obviously one of the things that every time we get, no matter who we get in the Super Bowl, there's always a larger question about legacy. Now, in some Super Bowls, there may not be much of a legacy. When you're talking about, for example, Super Bowl 37 between the Buccaneers and the Raiders, yeah, maybe the storyline was John Gruden coaching up against his former team, but I don't think a lot of people were looking at Rich Gannon and Brad Johnson in terms of Super Bowl legacy. But in this particular case, and for four out of the last five Super Bowls, we've been talking about a young man in Patrick Mahomes and what his impact would be. First Super Bowl, fine. Second Super Bowl, okay. Third Super Bowl, we're getting something. And now, of course, we've got another one to add. Charles Robinson at Yahoo Sports has sort of reminded people of this, is that when we get a consistent presence of an athlete in a championship, we naturally go to a, well, where exactly is this? What exactly are we doing with this? And in Patrick Mahomes' case, we're already jumping into the conversation of where he is on the timeline with Tom Brady. And I think it's funny that because the best example that he had of us doing this was Tiger Woods. When we started watching Tiger Woods win majors, we started saying, all right, he's after Jack Nicklaus. Where is he at his age to Jack Nicklaus at his age? Now, it's interesting because I remember Jack Nicklaus winning the 86 Masters at the age of 46 years old. Now, it doesn't seem ridiculous today in 2024 that a 45, 46, 47-year-old could win a golf major. Back in 1986, it was insane. The idea that a guy 4 years away from the senior tour could win a major championship was kind of crazy. And the way Jack Nicklaus was treated and talked about at the 86 Masters was a grandfather, right? I mean, his 20-year-old, 20-something-year-old son was his caddy. So it was the idea that Grandpa was winning the Masters. Remember how we thought about that with Tom Brady when he was winning Super Bowls at 44 years old and 42 years old? Like, this isn't supposed to happen. This really shouldn't exist. That a 40-year-old shouldn't be winning championships. And now that's what we have to do with Patrick Mahomes. When we started envisioning that Tiger could probably win majors in his 40s, and maybe even his 50s, when he was so dominant on the scene, the idea of catching Jack Nicklaus's 18 major championships seemed plausible. It almost seems like a mountain so big that Tom Brady has built, in a team sport especially, where you are as reliant to your success on things you can't control, rather than an individual sport like tennis or golf. The idea that we are already pegging a 28-year-old Patrick Mahomes with Tom Brady seems a little premature, but it also seems about right. This is basically what we were starting to notice from Brady. But I will caution people, this again, we don't know what Father Time does to each individual person. And Father Time can be really rough on you. And I don't mean Father Time in terms of age, I mean Father Time in terms of life. We had no idea that, for example, Tiger Woods would get into a marital altercation with his wife that required him to be gone off and disappear for a bit. And then injuries just started plaguing him in terms of his back and his knees and the surgeries and the overemphasis on Navy SEAL training, which what it did to his violent golf swing, let alone the car accident after he'd won the Masters in 2019. We don't know that with Patrick Mahomes. What we do know is that Tom Brady stayed relatively healthy, playing full games, full seasons, without any break. He played 16 seasons games a year for most of his career. And we don't know exactly where Mahomes is going to be when he reaches the age of 30 and 34, 35, because those years were still prime Tom Brady years, let alone 40s, 40, 41. First year at Tampa Bay, won the Super Bowl at 43. That is a lot to put on somebody. Now, maybe Mahomes doesn't need to get to 43 years old to have the same success. You know, it's funny because we always talk about Brady and the Patriots, and they were so dominant. They won Super Bowl 39 against the Philadelphia Eagles in Jacksonville. They would not win another Super Bowl until Super Bowl 49 when they beat the Seattle Seahawks. In between was two losses to the Giants. But that was a decade of not winning a Super Bowl. And that's exactly how we're going to define Mahomes' career in comparison to Brady. Is it the exact same thing as Jordan's six rings? Not really. I don't think Mahomes will need seven Super Bowl titles, but if he can get six in a shorter period of time, we're going to have a conversation about it. And I think that's what people want to do. We naturally gravitate to these kind of conversations. We naturally lead ourselves into these things when we start seeing somebody do something that's really out of the norm. It's one thing to get your team to a Super Bowl and win it. It's another thing to get them to two Super Bowls. Heck, it's another thing to get them to three. But when you get into four at 28 years old, now we're starting to wonder, okay, what does this mean? And by the way, something so extraordinary is never in our minds an outlier. Never has been. When we looked at Michael Jordan winning three championships, a break for 2 years, and three other championships, and in between he played minor league basketball and was out of the game for a bit, when we know he could have won eight in a row, we don't say, well, we'll never see that again. Put that on a shelf for another day. Let's just compare our guys now to other people other than that. We never do it. Never. Naturally, Tiger Woods had to chase Jack Nicklaus, and now we've got Patrick Mahomes, and people are leading us to a conversation about him and Tom Brady. Not Terry Bradshaw, who won four in 6 years. Not Joe Montana, who won four in the decade of the 80s. No. That's not where this conversation is going to be headed. Not those guys who had tremendous success in the Super Bowl, or even a Troy Aikman who won three Super Bowls in 4 years. Those guys did great, but they're not the GOAT. The GOAT is what we always look towards. The GOAT never is so separate, it's unfathomable to think about how it compares. We do it in tennis. We do it in golf. We do it in tennis. We do it in other sports. There's only one example I can think of right off the top of my head. Maybe there's some others, but like I was starting to think about this before the show, and I was like, well, Tour de France, that can't happen because we know the doping scandal had ripped that sport to shreds. But the only other example I can think of is Wayne Gretzky, where it's just implausible to think, because the game has changed and whatnot, that anything Gretzky ever touched would ever be close. So if you are looking at young hockey players today, a Connor McDavid, a Cale Makar, an Austin, the kid from Toronto there that's going up for 70 goals, you compare him to other greats, but you can't ever touch Wayne Gretzky. I'm not a hockey guy, so maybe that doesn't exactly happen in that hockey world. But that was the only one I could really think about, because even in baseball, people will chase Pete Rose's hit record or Babe Ruth's home run record. We always want to know, on what trajectory is this? And we're no different than Patrick Mahomes. So that's what this week is going to be about when we have different conversations. Everybody's going to be buzzing. And you'll see a lot more of this, these kind of articles of what a win would do for Patrick Mahomes and his legacy. We know for Brock Purdy, he would just be on a huge list of quarterbacks who won their first Super Bowl, but his is going to be a little different because it's coming with a franchise that has had Joe Montana, that had Steve Young. It brought a team back to glory that tried to win one with Colin Kaepernick and didn't, tried to win one with Jimmy Garoppolo and didn't. So Purdy, I mean, can you imagine being in the San Francisco Ring of Fame thing with Joe Montana and Steve Young as Super Bowl winning quarterbacks with the franchise? That's basically what's on the table for him. Mahomes, it's going to be a lot larger. And Andy Reid, especially, too, is going to be a lot larger. Because how far can they really take this duo? Again, when Belichick and Brady won their first Super Bowl, and we never really thought that they would win more, especially in the next year, when they didn't go back to the playoffs. Once it started rolling, you started realizing there is a coupling of a relatively young coach with a young quarterback that could grow together. Andy Reid is, that's not Andy Reid. Andy Reid is in his 60s. He's not likely to be taking Patrick Mahomes into his late 30s. So at some point, if Mahomes, if he's locked into the Chiefs like Brady was to the Patriots for 20 years, there's very likely that somebody else is going to be taking the reins of that team. And what would that mean for him? But that's what we're on the cusp of Super Bowl 58. Is a guy that if he is on that podium at the end at Allegiant Stadium, watch how people start immediately jumping to the, he's 28 doing this, Brady was 28 and doing this, and as Charles Robinson again points out at Yahoo Sports, that's exactly what we did every single time Tiger Woods won a major championship. Whether he was winning the British Open or the U.S. Open or whatever it was, PGA, Masters, we started saying, wow, at this age, he has this many. At this age, Jack had this many. And it was easy to see, wow, he only needs one major every 2 years to catch the record if he's going to win one at 46 like Jack Nicklaus. And we'll do the same thing with Patrick Mahomes if he emerges victorious this weekend. All right, we will continue. Some more thoughts on the Super Bowl, as again, the teams have arrived in Las Vegas to begin their preparations, and everybody is in town getting ready to start breaking this down as best we can before Sunday's game. We'll continue on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. It's Wake Up Call.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, so a programming note. We are in studio today. We are off tomorrow for travel, and then Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday from Las Vegas. We have the show on Sports Map Radio. Really excited.
Should be a
again,
good time.
I tell you right now, it's still like Vegas Super Bowl. It's crazy. Yeah. This is crazy.
And we promise to be back the following Monday.
Yeah, that's right. We will be back Monday. So we'll have all the analysis of Super Bowl 58 on Monday leading to that week. All right. So did you watch any of the Pro Bowl fun this weekend?
Of course I didn't.
I didn't know. I didn't either.
I think, you know, let me back that up. I saw it was definitely a replay of the skills competition. I watched C.J. Stroud, and then that was pretty much it.
That was it, yeah. I didn't watch the flag football game.
Nope.
I know that I saw some highlights of it and Stroud threw a really nice touchdown, but I will tell you, it is smart of the NFL to do the flag football game. And the only reason I thought about it was because when I saw the highlights and I saw the how many people were there, it was a good, the stadium was, there was a lot of people in the stadium for this. And I think the ability to see players and see their faces and sort of having some, you know, having really make it a fun environment, you know, lends itself to the entertainment of it. And I think that was that, you know, nobody really, even when you went to the Pro Bowl in Hawaii, nobody was really like, the AFC, I got to pull in for the AFC. Like, you just go for the entertainment. You go to see the players do some stuff, you know, be part of the atmosphere. And if you guys, you know, without wearing helmets and kind of flinging around in shorts and a t-shirt, you know, it's a little bit more entertaining. You bring the kids can see the players, etc. But other than that, from an entertainment value, I just didn't find any interest in the festivities, the skills competition, or anything. I mean, I watched a good amount of college basketball this weekend.
Yeah, I did that.
But I did not watch, I didn't give the Pro Bowl festivities any attention. And I know I was a kid, and I was all about football when I was younger. I watched the Pro Bowl in Hawaii all the time. I mean, I loved it.
And I don't know why, the skills competition back then, too, was a lot more fun.
Yeah. Yeah, so
you know,
the
fastest man, which Darryl Green seemed to have won every single year they
right.
had it.
And I guess I get when I get older, these things obviously are less and less important. But I just did not care that the Pro Bowl was being held. I didn't seem to be that interested in it.
I was happy to see that they got rid of the drop of football from a drone.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, that's cool.
See, I'm glad you told me that. I would have thought that would have been in there this year.
Well, I'm assuming it wasn't because they were indoors.
I didn't care. It was like, oops, I guess not. So anyway, that was going on this weekend. The NHL All-Star Game went on this weekend.
Missed that
too. I saw a little bit of it, but not a lot. Not a lot. Like I said, I watched a tremendous amount of college basketball. The more
well,
I think
Saturday
about it.
Was just loaded.
Saturday, I watched South Carolina, Georgia, the Gamecocks. I'm telling you, watch out for the Gamecocks at the SEC tournament. I don't know what they can do in the big tournament, but the SEC tournament, they fear absolutely nobody. Nobody. Georgia's a pretty good team. They fear nobody. And they won again. They now have 19 wins on the season. I watched them. Then I watched Kentucky and Tennessee, and I have no idea what was going on in the second half of that game. These guys were putting in – Tennessee, I think, scored 57 points in the second half. Kentucky had 50. They were flying that game. I saw Houston and Kansas. And I was watching yesterday I watched Wisconsin and Purdue. I was going to watch a lot of college basketball this weekend. It's really the only thing on in my house. We were doing some cleanup stuff. We still have the repairs to do in our house. We just kind of went around and cleaned up a little bit. My daughter came home from college making some food. And college basketball was just constantly on in our home. Watched Florida lose to Texas A&M. That was awesome. So, well, that was about it. But other than that, the other things that were going on, I didn't really watch. I just kind of kept it on that. And I don't mean this. It just was my first Sunday in a long time without football. And I'm like, oh, yeah, guess we'll roll with the college basketball season. But I do want to get into some golf a little bit. Because did you see the LIV tournament? They ended their round at night and in Mexico. And Joaquin Neiman won. He beat Sergio Garcia at the LIV golf event. And I couldn't care less who wins the LIV golf event. But I was very interested in what happened afterwards when Joaquin Neiman was talking to the media. He was excited. He won $4 million for winning this LIV event. $4 million. And afterwards, in the interview, he said, I want to win majors. I have to get in them. And it was sort of a reminder that these guys, every single one of them that made a deal with LIV Golf, if you're not a Masters champion, if you're not already in the top 5-10 in the world rankings until it starts to plummet a little bit, you're not going to the majors. You're not going to the majors. No matter what you win on the LIV Tour, you're not going to the majors. And Joaquin Neiman is a good young golfer who dreamed of winning the Masters, who dreamed of winning the PGA and the British Open and the U.S. They are not getting enough points and not credit on the LIV Tour to get into majors. Now, this is the deal they made when they went to LIV. They knew it. This wasn't a ruling that came down. They were hoping when they went to LIV that they would get a ruling that would put them in the majors, that they would get a official world ranking points. But you could tell the guy was elated to win, but he knew that this was going to be it, that he was going to win these shotgun start 54-hole tournaments that are not on network TV. And no majors. Come about it. When you think about a kid who wins a first PGA Tour event, what's the first thing he says? I get to go to the Masters. I get to go to the Masters. These guys don't. They don't get to go to the Masters. When they win, they get a big fat check, and that's it. And pats on the back from other LIV players telling them they're doing the right thing. That's it. Well done. Great. Great for the league. Great for the business. You played great. I think he shot like a 59 in one of the rounds. Yeah, it was awesome. Look at that. But nothing to hold on to it. I couldn't even find LIV. I was on CW, I guess. I didn't even realize I could have turned that on instead of maybe some college hoops. I didn't get that at all. So, all right, again, Super Bowl 58, we're going to be busting this down completely. We just talked earlier about Patrick Mahomes and everybody kind of attaching a legacy to Mahomes, and we're going to start doing that. Because that's what we want to do. Everybody wants to kind of say, what does this compare to? And I'm going to caution people to do it because, again, when you're talking about Tom Brady, you're not talking about a guy that won 7 Super Bowls in 9 years. Right? He won 7 Super Bowls over 20 years. Right? You always got to remember that because it is, I know it's difficult to kind of process in your head how long that career is. But again, when Tom Brady won in his first year with Tampa Bay, he was 43 years old. I can't imagine other players thinking that getting to 43 and playing at a high level, throwing for over 4,000 yards, et cetera, and guiding your team to the playoffs and through the rigors of the postseason, winning on the road at Green Bay, for example, I can't imagine getting just tapping that to anybody. Just tapping that to just, you know, hey, here you go, 43. He played until he was 45. And even at 45, I know we talk about that playoff game against Dallas. They were not competitive. But remember, even at 45 years old, what were we saying leading into that playoff game? Oh, yeah, the Buccaneers, they didn't have a very good season. But when the playoffs turn, the switch goes on and Brady goes into another mode. Now, he didn't in that playoff loss to Dallas. He didn't play particularly well, but he did throw it 66 times in that loss, completing 35 of them for 351 yards and two touchdowns at 45 years old. And sometimes we forget how age does affect everybody so differently. Going back to Jack Nicklaus, it wasn't even Nicklaus at 46 winning the Masters. The great Dan Jenkins once had a line about how Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson had what they called the duel in the sun that was at Turnberry in 1977. And in it, Dan Jenkins was commenting on the age of Jack Nicklaus, who's 37, and saying, go ahead, call him the old bear, you know, He used all of the descriptive language to talk about an old man playing against the young 27-year-old Tom Watson. But he also reminded people that even though Jack Nicklaus lost that British Open by one shot, he beat the rest of the field by six. The only person that beat him was one guy by one shot, but he had beaten everybody else by six. And these things have to be brought out because these things aren't normal. When it comes to age, these things aren't things we expect. And that's why everyone's going to go crazy on Mahomes being the new GOAT. And I'm not saying delay the conversation, but I'm kind of asking nicely to delay the conversation until he's at least 34. And then we might have a conversation. But instant success in your 20s, that's when it's supposed to come, when you're dominating at your position or you have a team around you where you use your dominance to help them dominate. But when we are talking about 34, 35, with kids growing up, whatever it may be for the Mahomes family, those are different aspects of a career that change your career. So I'm just asking people not to go completely crazy if Mahomes and the Chiefs absolutely, you know, win Super Bowl 58.
This is Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, you know what else is going to go on today? It's the State of the League by Roger Goodell.
Yes.
This used to be a free-for-all. Anybody that was credentialed to cover the Super Bowl could go to the press conference and ask Roger Goodell anything. This is basically what it is. It's like the State of the Union address with question and answers from the president. Right? He comes out. He gives a big statement about the league. He talks about the league's doing this, league's doing this, league's doing this. Blah 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 blah. And then he goes, any questions? Now imagine when the president gives a State of the Union address, if at the end of the speech he goes, any questions, and anybody could just ask a question about anything. Like, Mr. President, the school board in my town doesn't want to teach Catcher in the Rye. What are you going to do about it? He was like, I don't even know where are you from? So this used to be a free-for-all, and it was always cool because if you watched it or attended it, it was always like a million questions, different from ranging from everything. Now only 125 invited media members are going to be allowed to cover this. Yeah, exactly. So he's going to talk about how the NFL is doing great things with this, and the NFL is doing great things with this, and then I wonder what kind of questions are going to come.
But pre-written.
Probably pre-written and pre-approved.
As you're going through security, you know, you're being scanned and whatnot. It's like, oh, here's your question. Here's your question. And it'd be stupid questions like, so, are the Bears staying in Chicago?
That's right, yes. Is there a rumor that the Bears might be leaving Chicago? Can you address that? Nope, there is no truth to the rumor. Thank you so much, Commissioner. Keep doing the great work. Yeah, exactly. Real quick story. I remember when I was working in I was working in Las Vegas at the time, and we had a sports station that I worked at, and there was a news talk station that I worked at, and the news talk station was having a political candidate on who's running for mayor. And he was coming in, and they said, "We'll open up the phone lines to candidate Joe Smith, whoever it was." And the first question that came out of the gate was a young sounding girl, a woman, and she says, "Your stance on crime is second to none among the candidates." I was like, "What a planted question! Who opens the question by saying that?" I was like, "Can you imagine if that commissioner, your job here with the NFL has been absolutely stellar. From everything that you've touched has turned to gold. Can you tell us some of the great things that you have coming up for 2025 and beyond?"
Why, certainly.
Thank you for bringing that up.
What a brave question to ask.
Thank you, Adam Schefter. Right? But so now you don't know what you're going to get when it comes to this. But I gotta think that somebody is got to ask about officiating, right? Does somebody have to say, what are you guys going to do about technology and officiating so that you're not getting inundated with the it's all rigged conspiracy talk every time a play or a call was missed or it wasn't called correctly and there was no review or any of these other things? What can you do to fix it? Because the NFL has two choices here, right? It's gone. Like, we've been kind of talking about it all last week, and I promise I won't be dwelling on it much longer, but we talked about it all last week. The idea of these games being rigged and fixed is just exploding. It's exploding now.
Yeah.
Like, it's now beyond, like, it's beyond, it's not, it what is a genie out of the bottle kind of thing? Or what? You got to corral that in. Right. So if you're the commissioner, you got to corral that in because the integrity of your sport is in danger of being lost to every single person who feels emotionally down because of a play or a call or something along those lines. And there is technology out there that can help you. There is technology that can help you. And we don't want to bog the game down with replays after replays after replays. We don't. That's not the answer. But we can do something about ball placement, whether it crossed the plane, things like that, better camera angles with an official in the booth, radioing down. There's got to be ways of an official being helped by technology rather than us sort of pushing back on technology because of its expense, because of it could bog down the flow of the game. Because anytime an official goes, "Gee, I'm really sorry I missed that holding call. I wasn't in the right position." People go, "That's a bunch of crap. You are obviously being paid by the NFL mm-hmm. to make sure you didn't call that." And you go like, no, you can check my records, check my bank accounts, check my IRS. I'm not getting an extra $100,000 to make certain calls. Nope. Don't want to hear it. You clearly are. You clearly are a stooge for this league. You do exactly what the script tells you, and I'm not going to believe otherwise. Rather than the simplistic answer, the Occam's razor, if you will, which is simply they just weren't in a place to see it. And your camera that you see on TV was.
Yeah.
Right?
That's it. We've all become better officials than the guys actually running around trying to make a split-second decision and also trying not to get killed at the same time.
Because your eyes, quote-unquote, of the game are way different than his.
Yep.
You're getting a different view. You're getting an up view. You're getting one of those drone views. Not the drone views, the sky cam view. You're getting different angles. There's cameras everywhere.
Get it slowed down.
You're getting it slowed down to the exact frame of where you could see a guy go at somebody's knee.
Yep.
But in real time, an official may be blocked. His view may be obscured. He may not be in the right position. He may be looking at something else.
And when
your
really,
eyes are 20 times different.
And the one thing that has happened, because you know we have seen a rise in officials are terrible type of thing. I'll watch a football game now, and I get blown away. Like, how did you see that holding?
Yeah, right.
How did you see that? I mean, for me, I'm throwing a flag on. I mean, I know the cliche is that you could throw a flag on every single play.
Sure. Sure.
But, it's like there are times where I'm just looking, I'm like, how did you know that? How did you even see that?
It
blows my mind.
You know how you and I, we always joke about AI killing us?
Right? Yes.
We always say AI is going to kill us. And And there's going to be a generation that's like,
it's not really a joke, Tony.
It's not really a joke. But there's a generation that's coming, if they're not already here, that's going to go, no, AI is, we're going to use AI and we're going to work with AI to make our lives better.
You and I come from an age where newer and newer technology gets a little bit more scarier and scarier the way it gets power. That being said, do you think there's anybody that's going to scream on the rooftop if the NFL puts a chip in the football to determine where exactly it is located in terms of crossing a plane? Or
I don't
maybe
know why they
down?
Don't do that.
I don't either. Like, is anybody going to say, no, the old days were better when we did it by eyesight? Like, is anybody going to be like, really? It was better when we just randomly placed the ball on a quarterback sneak just anywhere we want, and it's a fourth down play, and then they bring out the chains, and we go, yeah, we don't even know where this ball really is, but I guess we'll just plant it here and see what happens.
No, somebody will do that because it'll go against their team.
Sure, of course.
Oh, what are they talking about? That microchip doesn't know anything. That ball was like 3 yards behind the line of scrimmage. What, huh?
The laser sensor was, you know, indicated touchdown, but it was all it was all rigged anyway.
We've said it before. I don't know when it happened. Like when the moment they decided to use this technology and everyone just said, okay, but tennis has one of the best systems around and no one disputes it.
And you're right. That's the key. If you're a player, right, and you hit a shot and the guy goes out and you go, What? And you scream it, and then they show the video. You go, sorry about that. Yeah, I guess I was out. My bad. Like that, it's just universally accepted.
Yeah, and I don't.
No one's thinking it's rigged or somebody's changing the computer to give another image.
And when did that happen?
Right.
It was it was nothing. It was just one day where you're watching John McEnroe go flip it over someone, and then the next is just the ball hit the line.
Yeah.
Okay. If you say so.
I guess. My bad. And then sometimes they'll say out. They'll show the video, and it's in, and the ref kind of goes, eh.
Yeah. Okay. And then and then you look at the player, like the player knows.
Player goes.
The player saw it. He saw it the entire time.
Knew it all along.
So, why can't we just adopt that technology into football where it's, you know, he threw it past the line of scrimmage, or he did reach the first down, or he did reach a touchdown?
Because watching football as long as I've had since I was a kid until now, I have zero idea when there's a quarterback sneak and it's just a pile of bodies and the ref comes in and goes, I guess, and they need a yard. And it's like, we're now talking inches, like really, really are important, right?
Yeah.
Like every inch is important. And the official just takes the ball and goes, here.
Yeah, because he has no idea. Like when they do, what is it, what's the Philadelphia Eagles one? The push-tush?
The tush-push.
Tush-push or whatever. I mean, he immediately goes down onto a pile, and there are just 1,000 people on top of him.
Right.
And you mean to tell me that through all that you're able to spot the ball? Because I guarantee the quarterback, Jalen Hurts, I guarantee that as the pile starts to loosen up, he's slowly moving that ball forward anyways.
Yeah. And you start going, oh, okay. I guess we'll just plant it here.
I guess it was here where it stopped.
Because we're going to bring the chains over, and if you've planted it too far ahead or too far behind, it's going to alter this game at this moment. Right? It's 4th and 1, and they tried to go for it, and where you plant it. So I can't imagine anybody jumping up and down and screaming, chips in the football or some sort of laser thing is technology. But if you're Roger Goodell, you've got to somehow get a fishnet around all of this crazy conspiracy talk. And that could be one thing you can start saying, hey, we got to tighten up officiating, make it better, make it easier, because it's getting out of hand.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, thanks for joining us as we continue along on, again, a Super Bowl Monday as we continue. All right, so I did want to bring this up because I figured this week we're going to be so busy and I'm going to forget to talk about it. But we were talking about what we were watching this weekend. I watched a lot of college basketball Saturday. I watched some Wisconsin-Purdue yesterday. Didn't really watch anything later in the afternoon. Took my daughter out to dinner. But I did make time over the weekend to watch the We Are the World documentary on Netflix.
Okay.
Now, did you see that it's there? You probably didn't see it, but it's there. So there's this about an hour and a half documentary on the making of We Are the World from 1985. And, you know, I was like, well, I'm just flipping through looking for things to watch. And I'm like, you know what? I'll dive into this. It's interesting because they got like Bruce Springsteen and Huey Lewis and Lionel Richie to talk about it 40 years later, close to 40 years later to talk about it. And I was like, okay, I always wanted to know the story on how they put that record together. For those of you who don't know the story, for you maybe too young, but there was an album that came out in the mid-80s, and it was for African famine relief. And it was basically the United States record artists' answer to Do They Know It's Christmas that was done by British singers to raise money for the famine that was going on in Ethiopia. Bob Geldof had put it together, and then in the United States, Ken Cragen, who was a record producer, wanted to do the same thing. He wanted to get as many artists as he could to sing this one song, send it out as a single, and all the proceeds would go to famine relief in Africa. And when, like, I was a teenager back then, and it was a big hit, it was a big song, and African famine was like on the news all the time, and you started noticing that, you know, people were starting to get more and more aware of it. And then, but when they put the album out, and it was a great album, you started going, oh my God, they got Billy Joel on this thing, they got Willie Nelson, they got Kenny Rogers, Lionel Richie, Smokey Robinson, Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, Bob Dylan. You start going, wow, wow. You start hearing stories about how they put this together. Oh yeah, it was the American Music Awards, and they just told a bunch of artists, hey, when this thing's over, go to this record studio, and we're going to cut this album. And I just sort of went, that's what they did. Right. And I never really knew the story. Now, I'm not dumb enough to know how I didn't think they all just showed up, recorded an album and left. I kind of knew there was a process, but I didn't know how long that process is. You know, I'm like, I don't know how a record is made. And I certainly don't know how a record was made in 1985 in terms of the engineering and just putting it together and the music and all of that. And I always thought the story was kind of incomplete. Like, how exactly did this go down? So this documentary was intriguing to me because I also know that if we did it today, it wouldn't have the same impact. Like, there would be so many people going, you know, the combined wealth of the people in this room is 575 million, whatever it is. And then you have a bunch of people saying, how dare they tell us to give money to famine relief when they could support it themselves? You know how we are now. We're just more cynical than ever before. But back then, these were, you just bought the album. It was great for a good cause, and the music, the song was catchy and good. And it was written by Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie, and was performed by 20-something people, from Kim Carnes to Sidney Lauper to, again, all of those artists. So I spent an hour and a half watching this thing, and it really was fantastic. It really was. It was it's a time machine, man. You like they had all the video. They brought in one camera guy to film the entire thing. His job was to film everything, and they were going to use it for different kind of promos and things like that, and some, you know, send out the news clips of it. And he was on the documentary talking about it. Like, you're a few years younger than me, but you remember what a big deal the 80s famine relief was. I mean, from Live Aid to all of it.
For me, Ethiopia was less than a third world country.
Yeah. I mean, they were dying every day.
All I thought about was just like the entire country is starving.
I remember teachers talking about it in school. I mean, it was on the news all the time. And, but you know what hooked me into this documentary, man? You know what? When I watched the teaser promo that they put out, what hooked me into this documentary was, they were talking about one of the girls that was responsible for the talent. She was working as the talent was coming in. She was walkie-talkieing in who was coming in, and they show a clip, and she's walkie-talkieing that Billy Joel and Christie Brinkley arrived. And here's this limousine that pulls up, and Billy Joel gets out with Christie Brinkley, 1980s Christie Brinkley.
Is that the beginning?
Yeah. Yeah.
Beginning
just
of the courtship?
Start of the marriage. Yeah, whatever it was. Yeah. Gives her a kiss, goes in. I'm like, geez, that's this guy.
How?
This guy.
Still
unbelievable.
To this day, how?
This guy's how he did that. You know what's funny about Billy Joel's story? I didn't know this either. So when he wrote Uptown Girl, he wanted his girlfriend at the time to be in the video. And his girlfriend said, I can't. I can't make the filming, but I got a friend who would be perfect for it. And the friend, the girlfriend was Elle McPherson. He was dating Elle McPherson at the time he was making the video for Uptown Girl. And his girlfriend, Elle McPherson, said, you should contact my friend Christy Brinkley. She'd be good for this.
Yeah. You know, something similar to that happened to me in the fifth grade, Tony. Yeah, I remember that happening to me in the fifth grade.
I know, right?
A girl said, you know, you shouldn't go out with me. You should go out with my friend. And I was
right.
Like, okay.
Okay, sure.
Fifth grade.
Oh, God, Billy Joel. How insane was that? But the one thing you start realizing, like, there's all these egos, right? And they're just tremendous amount of egos. There's only one guy. They say it right in the beginning of the documentary. There's only one guy they wanted for this, right? That could handle all the egos. Like, literally when he says, stop talking, record, we're recording, that everyone would listen to. And that was Quincy Jones. There's only one guy. They're like, Quincy Jones is the only guy that could, when he went, guys, we're recording. Everyone shut up. And everyone went right to their place and we're done. He was the only one that could command the room. And they got him, and he helped put it together, and he helped organize it. There's, like, all these arguments about who's got what part. Everyone's wondering, can I sing here? Can I sing? Quincy Jones goes, nope. Stevie Wonder wanted to change the lyrics. Nope. Somebody wanted to sing with another artist. Nope. Quincy Jones was like, guys, we got one night to do this. No one is coming back to record this. We are recording it tonight. Either be here or leave. I don't care, but we're doing it right now tonight. And everybody listened to him. Stevie Wonder wanted to put in a line in Swahili in the song. And Waylon Jennings walked out, said, I'm not doing that. They're like, and then somebody said, Stevie, they don't even speak Swahili in Ethiopia. And then Quincy Jones went, enough, done. We're not talking about, this is the song, these are the lyrics, that's it. Done. It was awesome to watch. Like, he's all these people. They're huge. They're mega stars. There's mega stars you can get in the 1980s. And Quincy Jones is like, shut up, sing. And they did. They ran the room. Fantastic documentary. Great piece of work.
I remember that, seeing that video for the first time and just being in awe, but I never knew the complexity of it.
Oh yeah, and
when I was younger,
they have a clock. They show a clock, right, in the thing of, like, and it's like they started around 10 because the American Music Awards, obviously being on the West Coast, ended at a certain time on the East Coast, which is still relatively early for Los Angeles.
West Coast, yeah,
right. So it's not like when you're going to bed at 11 in New York watching the American Music Awards, and you're like, okay, it's over. To them, it's like 8 o'clock. You know, it's like, okay, it's only 8. You do your press, and then you get in a limousine, and you go. And about 10 o'clock is when every one of them starts to arrive, and they start putting it together. They start going, okay, let's do this. But the clock, they should keep showing the clock. It's like 4 a.m., 5 a.m., 7 a.m. Like, they're hungry. They're ordering food in the middle of the night to have it delivered. They had to keep the place a secret, and hardly anybody knew where they were, and it was insane. And it took that long to make this record with all of these guys, all these egos that were in there, and Quincy Jones had to run the show. And it was a really good documentary. If you really kind of, and by the way, Dan Aykroyd's in it, which made no sense to me that Dan Aykroyd was there
singing.
Yeah, singing, right. Like next to, like, Kenny Loggins, well, of all people.
Blues Brothers era?
Maybe. That might have been it. You might be right. Because remember, he did that Blues Brothers stuff. That was pretty popular back
then.
Yeah. So they probably grabbed him in Ghostbusters and all those movies.
But it also might have just been like, oh, Dan Aykroyd said he'll come. Put him on.
Yeah. And the one woman that wowed the room was Cyndi Lauper. When Cyndi Lauper sang her part of the song, they all clapped. She could belt. I mean, she could belt. So anyway, that's my little Netflix recommendation if you're looking for something to watch to. Bide your time until we get to Super Bowl Sunday. If you kind of remember that era, it's a good little time machine. We'll continue. It's Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.